You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if it feels like you're getting a lot of pre-recorded calls from telemarketers lately, you're not alone in that feeling. We'll find out how to hopefully reduce the number of robocalls we're getting.
First, reports show that last year, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos had his phone hacked through a popular messaging service called WhatsApp. Investigators hired by Bezos say the hack was tied to the Saudi Arabian government and that they targeted his personal messages and photos.
While we might move in different social circles than Jeff Bezos, there are still plenty of hacking dangers the everyday user can fall victim to. And no matter who you are, sticking to a few best practices can help keep your information secure.
Sarah Morrison is a reporter covering personal data and privacy for Recode's open sourced project and Vox.com's open source project, which looks at the hidden consequences of technology. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks. You know, there's a lot that's still unclear about the details around this Jeff Bezos hack, but what do we know about how his phone was compromised?
So he had a WhatsApp on his phone, which is, you know, a messaging app, and I guess he was messaging with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, like as you do.
As one does, right?
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, you know, as we all do. And at some point, they believe the prince sent him a message with a video in it, and that was automatically downloaded onto his Bezos' phone and had some kind of malware or virus in it that then transmitted pretty much everything that was on his phone back to the prince or whoever was working on his behalf.
You know, we kind of tongue-in-cheek referenced it there, but Jeff Bezos, a pretty high-profile target, right? But for everyday people, what are the relevant things we should take away from the dangers this has revealed?
I think the biggest thing that people can take away, and maybe the most surprising thing for people when they hear the story, is that an app that promotes itself as being extremely secure could get hacked. And I think, you know, I don't think, you know, the app has said that this is what happened and this is our fault. I'm pretty sure they haven't. But even so, it promotes itself as being secure and says, you know, it's encrypted. Your messages are encrypted. And actually, that is what happened. That's still fine. There's no indication that anything went wrong there. So the tool that it promotes itself as being secure for was still secure. I think what most people are surprised about is that there's still ways to get around that if you really want to. So I guess the message that most of us could take away from it is that don't assume that anything is secure. Don't let down your guard. You know, even if you think something is secure and quote unquote, like unhackable, because, you know, nothing is.
And despite those headlines, though, it sounds like WhatsApp is still considered one of the more secure messaging services. Why is that?
Because it is encrypted. It offers something called end-to-end encryption, which basically means, you know, you send a message and it's when it goes out, it's encrypted. Anybody who receives it besides the person you send it to can't see what is actually in it. And then again, the person that you send it to gets it and then it's unencrypted on their device. So if you don't want your message to get intercepted or seen by anybody in between, it won't be, you know, generally. I guess there's always things that can go wrong, but I think there aren't any that we know of.
And are
so that
there,
is why it is most it's considered to be still be secure.
And beyond WhatsApp, are there other services like this, other encrypted messaging services?
Yeah, I think there's several. I think something called Vibe, Signal, I know, Telegram. There are several. I think if you just look up messaging and, you know, end-to-end encryption, you'll find a bunch. WhatsApp is by far the most popular, most well-known.
And when people use WhatsApp or other means of hacking into our devices, what are they looking to get?
I mean, I think ultimately, I mean, not necessarily with Jeff Bezos, where I think that looks like it was information, but I think most people want to make money. So they're going to target things, you know, if you're just a regular, normal person, that will get money one way or the other.
Sarah Morrison is a reporter covering personal data and privacy for Recode, and we're talking about keeping our phones and other devices safe in the wake of news that Jeff Bezos' phone was hacked, reminding us that ours could be too. And Sarah, you recently wrote about a hack that you were victim of, and it cost you some money. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, this is great. So I am a data privacy reporter, and, you know, a long time ago before I was, a more innocent time, so like 5 months ago, I didn't practice all of the best practices to prevent this kind of stuff, and so I was. And basically, I can't be absolutely sure what happened, but what I'm pretty sure happened and what is just good advice for everybody to follow is I use the same password or a pretty close version of it in most of the accounts that I had. And I did that for like 10 years. So I believe at some point one of the services or maybe many of them I used got hacked and my password got out there. Somebody got it and just used it as many places as they could to hack into my accounts and use them. So they got two meal delivery apps. They got into two of those and ordered Asian cuisine, and to a total of, I think it's $103.91. And then they hacked into my bank account and wired about $13,000 away. So... and I got it back. I did end up getting it all back, but it was, you know, it was several days of concern.
I mean, I panicked for you thinking about $13,000 just being gone.
Yeah, it wasn't great. It wasn't fun.
And where do you start then? How do you figure that out and make sure that it doesn't happen to you again?
So I have like three ways that I think this could have been avoided. I don't want to say with absolute certainty. I think everybody should assume that there's a way to hack them and it could happen. These are just sort of ways to, I guess, not be the lowest hanging fruit for hackers, make things more difficult. And I think the first would have been to use different passwords, different things, and sort of switch them up somewhat frequently, not every 10 years, so that if one service that you use gets hacked and your password for one service gets out there, it's not getting out there for everything, including, you know, your bank. So that would have been, you know, my first advice. The second one would have been enabling something called two-factor authentication on as many things as possible, which I actually do. My bank offered an authentication app that I didn't use. And it's, if you want, I can sort of explain a little bit what that means, because it sounds like a complicated term that I think turns a lot of people off of something that is pretty simple and useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think more companies, more organizations, employers are actually requiring that to have people log into their system. So tell us more about two-factor authentication.
So basically, at its most simple, it's just using two different methods to log into an account. So generally what you do is you put in, you know, your username and your password, and then you log in. And this would be you put in your username and your password, and then a code is sent to, depending on what you use here, your phone, like in a text message or, you know, an app. And then you just type that code in, and then you log in. So somebody has to have, like, physical possession of, say, your phone or whatever that app is on in order to be able to complete the login process, which, you know, a hacker generally won't.
And what about the fact that they had access to your credit cards? How are you hoping to avoid that in the future?
Yeah, and this is actually something I think a lot of people do without realizing, including me, is, you know, a lot of your accounts, you have your credit card just saved onto it, like, you know, for future use, make it easier to order something because your credit card's right there. You don't have to enter it in over and over again. I have my credit card information just saved onto those two meal delivery apps, so all someone had to do once they got in there was order food, and then my credit card was charged for it. So I would say, you know, if you're able to not attach your credit card to your accounts, you know, don't. And then just, you know, enter your credit card in every time you have to. It's a lot less effort and pain than it being on there and someone using it in the end.
And we breezed past this, but I do want to circle back to passwords before we're done here, because your advice was don't use the same password, even different little versions of it, switching an I to an exclamation point, because people can figure that out. But it's really intimidating that you're saying use different passwords for everything. How on earth are we supposed to keep them straight?
So what I do now is I have, you know, an app that's a password manager. Basically, I just put in all of my passwords for everything, and it just sort of keeps track of them all. So I just have to refer to it to log into things. It actually will generate complicated, nonsensical passwords for you, so you don't have to think of them yourself. It's pretty easy to use, but it's another step. I think a lot of times people's browsers and computers, like I think Apple computers, Apple phones, will do that for you. They'll say, save this in a keychain. So that's another way you can do it. And I think the other thing I recommended, which, again, security experts really kind of vary on this one, so I don't want to, like, wholeheartedly recommend it, but I think it's better than nothing, is write them all down somewhere, like in a book, and keep that book safe. But then that way, again, you've just got some kind of account of all of them, because you're not going to remember them all. That's somewhere. And again, I personally think that's better than what happened to me, which is, you know, $13,000.
And whether it's a book or a password manager, again, assume that it's safe, but that you're not completely safe.
Yeah, I mean, look, everything can be hacked. It's really a process of, you know, just doing your best on your end and hoping everything else falls into place and choosing your friends maybe more wisely in terms of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time today.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Sarah Morrison is a reporter covering personal data and privacy for Recode and Vox's open sourced project. She talked with us about the best ways to keep our digital devices secure after Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos allegedly had his cell phone hacked through the WhatsApp messaging service.
Coming up, hacking isn't the only problem you might have with your phone. We'll find out how to reduce the number of pesky robocalls you get. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the Senate impeachment trial.
First, you likely get a lot of pre-recorded phone calls coming to you, maybe something from the doctor reminding you about an appointment, some political campaigning maybe happening right about now. But then there are the people trying to sell stuff or potentially scam you. Things get a little fuzzier there.
Our next guest is going to clear up any confusion we might have about robocalls, legal versus illegal, and tell us how to reduce the number of calls we receive.
Tiffany Bernhardt Schultz is the Southwest Wisconsin Regional Director at Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Tiffany, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
Now, you are out, Tiffany, in the public on behalf of the Better Business Bureau pretty often, and I'm guessing this is a question that comes up pretty often for you, isn't it?
This question comes up every time I'm out at a consumer or business-facing event. How do we reduce the number of those calls that we get to our phones? So hopefully we can give a few tips here and help those consumers out there who are listening.
Before we get into the advice portion of our conversation, it feels like there are a lot of robocalls out there. Is that just perception or is it reality? Are we getting more of them over time?
That is reality. The FTC reported 5 billion robocalls that were made.
Our line's breaking up there with Tiffany. We'll try to reconnect in just a moment. Tiffany Bernhardt Schultz from the Better Business Bureau talking about robocalls. Just checking in with her. We've heard from a lot of people on Facebook about this. Lindsay says, for years, I've gotten a couple a week from a company that just starts going on in some Asian language. I have zero idea who they are, what they want, what they're saying, how to stop it. You can share your stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tiffany, I don't know if a robocaller was trying to break in there. Your line was breaking up, though. So talk a little bit more about those numbers of the increase in robocalls.
So the FTC reported 5 billion robocalls in November alone, and that was almost 2,000 calls per second. Many of these calls are coming from overseas, so that's a lot of phone calls that are hitting our phones here from American consumers.
How do we define a robocall?
A robocall is a pre-recorded message coming from a scammer. They're maybe getting those phone calls claiming the lower utility bills or credit card rates, government grants, vacation packages, and calls coming from individuals posing as IRS agents. Those are all illegal calls. If you do receive a call coming from a candidate running for office or charities asking for donations, messages reminding you about an appointment or a call from your child's school indicating that their lunch balance is low, those are called legal calls. So there's a difference between a sales pitch and a non-sales pitch. And most of those calls we get are those, you know, bogus calls that are coming from scammers overseas.
Do we know how these bogus calls are finding our numbers? How are they catching us? Tiffany?
I'm here.
Okay. Yeah. How are they getting our numbers, Tiffany?
They buy them from lists. You give personal information on a website. You're registering for a contest that you may not know where they're using your personal information if you're not reading that fine print in that privacy policy. you could be giving your phone number to a marketing company who's selling that off to these scammers who buy and list. Some of it is found in the dark web when you're going on bogus websites. They're looking for you to accept those terms and conditions. There's all different ways that they're gaining access to your phone number.
All right, so we're getting these calls. We get a bogus call. Are we just stuck, or is there something we can do that's hopefully going to lower the number of those calls in the future?
Definitely hang up. If you pick up that phone and you get the recorded sales pitch, hang up. Don't speak. Don't press a button to supposedly remove your name from a list. And if you get a call from the IRS or Social Security, don't trust it. Scammers know how to fake that caller ID. If you don't know that number that's calling you, just don't answer it in the first place. Send it on through to your voicemail.
Let's bring on a caller. Jeff is with us in West Salem. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, hi. I told the producer there that I quit answering calls that I don't recognize. You know, a lot of people don't call me anyway, so I don't recognize the call. I don't pick it up. And I've been doing that for about 2 years or so now, and I think I'm down to maybe one or two robocalls a week.
Interesting. So if we don't answer, the well might dry up a little bit, Tiffany. Have you seen that?
That's correct, because if you answer, they're gaining access to a working phone number. If you don't answer, they are not reaching a real person. So the chances of you graduating to another list are more slim. So that's a great practice to use. If you don't know that number, don't call them back. Don't answer the phone.
I know we can report this. The website is ftc.gov/complaint. But I think a lot of people, and I'll put myself on this list, might feel like, well, what's one complaint going to do? Does it make a difference? Is it worth taking the time to report a scam call, a suspicious call?
It is worth it, because phone companies are now cracking down on blocking those calls that are coming in. So there's less and less calls getting through to consumers. So the more proactive that everybody can be in helping track down these calls and the numbers that they're coming from, the more these agencies can do their work and get these calls stopped.
Is there legislation in the works or government action in the works to try to crack down on that those billions of robocalls we might see?
There is, and they're all doing their part in blocking these calls. So you can either block by reporting the call to your cell phone provider. Sometimes the cell phone providers are blocking the calls. You may see your caller ID saying scam call, so that's an indication not to answer it. And you don't want to waste these callers' time by answering the phone. So the best thing to do is to block it either through your phone provider or just on your phone itself.
Those do not call lists at the state and federal levels used to be a big deal. Are they still around, and do they make a difference?
Yes, they are still around. And if you're not on that list, you should definitely get yourself on that list. If you're not sure that you're on the list, re-register for the list and make sure that all your phones are registered on that list as well, your landlines and your cell phones.
And sometimes I've heard people say over the years, well, I did it, but it's not working. I'm still getting calls from political candidates and nonprofits. Well, the do not call list doesn't affect those. Do I have that right?
Candidates running for office or charities asking for donations, those are considered legal calls at this point. So you have to exclude those from what's considered an illegal call. And those illegal calls, like I had mentioned earlier, coming from bogus companies claiming to lower utility bills or credit card rates, government grants, vacation packages, and calls from individuals posing as IRS agents. Now, I'm sure we all have our laundry list of who we've received these phone calls, mm-hmm. and this is not an all-encompass list, but it is some of the more popular ones that are hitting consumer cell phones today.
Now, Tiffany, what if someone has taken that call and believed it was really the IRS or whatever? They've taken the first steps toward something that's a scam, or maybe they find out a relative has done this. What can we do? Or do we have any recourse if we're down that road of being scammed?
The IRS will never contact you by phone, so that's a red flag. If somebody contacts you by phone from the IRS or Social Security, take that as a red flag. If you have been a victim of a scam, please report it to us at bbb.org/scamtracker. That's bbb.org/scamtracker, and take steps to report it to your local police as well.
Now, Shirley on Facebook brought up a different point. She says, you know, you can hang up on that robocall. Sometimes you get a call, though, she says, from real people on the other end, you know, working their way down a clipboard or a computer list of names and numbers. She says, in this case, to ask for donations. Do different rules apply if there's a human actually talking to you on the other end of that line?
It depends on the type of call it is. So sometimes it starts out with a robocall that's an automated dialer, and then it'll ask you to press a number, and then a real person will come on, which will be sometimes a scammer. So you have to distinguish the call, who's calling you, and is it for a legitimate reason. But the first thing that we would recommend is not to answer the call in the first place if you don't know the number that it's coming from. That's the best plan of action that we can give you at this point.
And, you know, there was a change a while back where, oh, well, that's my local area code, so there's a good chance it's a legitimate call. Turns out these scammers have learned to spoof our area codes. Is that right?
That's correct. So we're seeing these local calls. You may see a 608 area code coming in. You might see a 414 area code coming in. And you think it's somebody from your own community. And it very well could be a scammer on the other end. So don't let an area code fool you. If you don't know that number, just don't answer it. And if you do accidentally answer it and you don't know the person on the other line, don't feel guilty for hanging up on them, because they are 99% of the time it's going to be a scammer on the other line.
Well, Tiffany, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this.
Thanks for having me.
Tiffany Bernhardt-Schultz is the Southwest Wisconsin Regional Director at Better Business Bureau, serving Wisconsin. She joined us today to talk about robocalls and how to reduce the number of calls you receive. And there's still time for you to share maybe your experience and what you do when you get these calls. Let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We don't have the WhatsApp app on our official phones here, so you can't... You know, you can't hack into anything here with WhatsApp. Sorry.
Nope, we're covered.
Sorry, scammers.
Coming up, this is the final day of testimony in the Senate impeachment trial ahead of tomorrow's scheduled vote. We'll get the latest on what's happening today. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, we've got a recap of tonight's State of the Union. The president is set to lay out his priorities, hear about what makes the list, and how Democrats are responding tomorrow morning after 7 o'clock right here on the Ideas Network.
Now, U.S. senators are making their final statements today in the impeachment trial of President Trump. Tomorrow, senators are scheduled to either convict or acquit the president on two articles of impeachment, abuse of power, and obstruction of Congress.
As a reminder, Democrats in the House have accused President Trump and his administration of withholding congressionally approved foreign military aid to Ukraine to pressure Ukraine to announce an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden, one of the president's political rivals.
Our next guest joins us to talk about today's testimony and the political impact of the trial.
Paul Nollet is an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, great to be here.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it. What's your takeaway from these final testimonies that we're hearing today?
Yeah, I think overall not much has really changed about the prospects of acquittal, which really since the beginning of the process when the House sent over articles of impeachment, that seemed like that was that really hasn't changed too much. What has changed is whether there are going to be any crossover votes. There was some expectation that some senators like Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski of Maine and Alaska respectively would cross over and be Republicans voting to remove Trump from office. But they both announced that they were not going to do that. So it certainly looks like it's shaping up to be a very down-the-line party vote.
And specifically today, Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, said that the House managers proved that Trump demonstrated very poor judgment, but didn't convince her he should be removed from office. So splitting hairs there between, you know, what has been proven and then, I guess, what the remedy might be.
That does seem to be a pretty popular line amongst the somewhat more moderate members of the Republican Senate caucus, or at least the ones who have been more openly critical of Trump, is to say, well, I don't think this goes to the level of removal from office, but nevertheless, Trump did certain things wrong, and I'm going to state that. So it's a little bit of a different tone than some of President Trump's fiercest defenders in the Senate, but nevertheless, they are still voting for acquittal at the end.
And as we're discussing those defenders, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky started the testimony today. He stood in support of the president. Here's part of what he had to say about the Democrats and the impeachment proceedings.
Here's their real position, Mr. President. Washington Democrats think President Donald Trump committed a high crime or misdemeanor the moment he defeated Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. That is the original sin of this presidency, that he won and they lost. Ever since, the nation has suffered through a grinding campaign against our norms and institutions from the same people who keep shouting that our norms and institutions need defending.
We've heard this argument from Republicans before, that the impeachment, even the Mueller investigation, was because they didn't believe that President Trump's election was legitimate. Is that resonating with people?
Yeah, I mean, certainly amongst Republicans who overwhelmingly think that the president should be acquitted and agree with Mitch McConnell right there. Now, I also think that there is a certain percentage, not a large percentage of Americans, typically around 6 to 8% in polls, who don't approve of President Trump's conduct here, but nevertheless think that he should be acquitted. And part of the reason may be because they say, well, you know, it's an election year. In November, everyone's going to have the chance to decide. So let's just leave it up to the voters. And I think that part of that argument has, in fact, resonated with enough Americans to not turn the tide against President Trump completely in this whole debate.
So you think it's an effective strategy for Republicans to say they're trying to undo an election and to mess with the next one, so don't fall for this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is effective, and it especially when the entire impeachment episode spilled over into this current year, 2020, I think that argument got even stronger, because then it put in people's minds, well, look, the election is just a few months down the road, so perhaps we can let the voters decide there. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily the right argument. I mean, Democrats certainly will push back and say this is about norms and the rule of law and such, and so we need to act regardless of the fact that an election is coming up. But nevertheless, I think that was enough to convince a very slight majority of Americans that Trump does not deserve to be removed from office.
Paul Nillette is an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We're talking about the latest in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. A majority of Democratic senators have taken issue throughout this process with the fact that witnesses weren't allowed to be part of the Senate impeachment trial. Let's take a listen now to Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut.
I'll remember the moment that we raised our hands, took an oath to be impartial. All 100 of us, 99, at the same time, in a historic moment when the weight of that responsibility shook me like a rock. And I will remember also the shame and sadness that I felt when this body, supposedly the greatest deliberative body in the history of the world, voted to close its eyes, to put on blinders, to evidence, witnesses, and documents, first-hand knowledge, eyes and ears on the president, black and white, documents don't lie, that were necessary to understand the complete story and give the American people the complete truth.
So there's that criticism of the process. Paul, what do you think is the effect of a lack of witnesses or other evidence at this stage in the long term?
So in the long term, I think it does help to fire up Democrats who thought that President Trump, in fact, did impeachable conduct and conduct for which he should be removed from office. And they view Republicans as just shutting this down in a very partisan way and not even allowing all the facts to come out. And so I think the long-term effect is to fire up the Democratic side with that sort of argument, whereas Republicans are firing up their base with the argument that Democrats have been against President Trump since the day he lost, or rather he won the election against Hillary Clinton. So I think a lot of this rhetoric back and forth at this point is really about connecting with each party's base.
And you mentioned the rhetoric because we actually hear some of the defense of the Constitution from both Republicans and Democrats in this conversation. What's different, though, in what we're hearing on the Senate floor than at news conferences is the tone that senators are taking. It is really solemn. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, and I think it is a reflection of the fact that these sorts of proceedings do not happen very often. I mean, it's very rare for any sort of impeachment proceedings to happen in an impeachment trial of any federal official, never mind the President of the United States. And so I think that the senators are recognizing that this is a serious moment. And I think both of them have a political reason for doing so. The Republicans saying this is, we are taking our duty seriously and we've decided there's not enough evidence here, and Democrats taking very much the opposite argument. But I think it's a little bit different than your typical partisan debate. I mean, in part because at least until today and a little bit yesterday, senators by and large were not even allowed to speak during much of this time. So I think that also played into it.
Yeah, certainly. We even saw the notes of the questions being passed for the Chief Justice to read and not even hearing directly from those senators at that time. We're talking to Paul Nolet, political scientist at Marquette University, and he's with us about the ongoing impeachment trial.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. The proceedings likely come to an end tomorrow afternoon. What do you think about the process that you've seen in impeachment? What would you hope for with the outcome tomorrow? Expected to be a party line vote for the most part for acquittal. Do you think that is the right outcome? Do you think whatever the outcome is, that the process has done justice to the issues that have been raised? Or would you have liked to have seen something different, maybe witnesses or documents brought in? Or would you have liked to see nothing, not an impeachment process at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We continue this conversation in just a bit right here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keeley Boltina. And we're talking about the impeachment trial in the Senate as lawmakers make the case to either convict or acquit President Trump. Our guest is Paul Nolet, associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about the process or maybe the politics behind it and your thoughts. What do you think about this ongoing trial likely to end tomorrow afternoon with a vote in the Senate? How do you want that vote to come out, regardless of what you think will happen? Do you think the trial was worth it, even if nothing ends up changing? Do you think it was good to get these issues out in the open? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And now we want to welcome Peggy from Brooklyn, Wisconsin, to the conversation. Peggy, thanks for giving us a call.
Hi. Thank you for all you do for the average Joe out there listening to the radio. You lay it out there the way it should be. I really think they should have had witnesses, and I'm really upset that the Democrats and Republicans cannot work together for the better of the people. And I do think they should have had this impeachment process for the sole reason that in the beginning, the Republicans and their attorneys said that, no, they did nothing wrong. And in the end, they said, well, okay, yeah, you've proven that they did wrong. They also, along with President Trump, and I have a real big problem with them just following along. I actually think that there are a lot of Republicans out there that are really in fear for their life and their family. My honest opinion.
Peggy, thanks for weighing in on that. Paul Nolet, we're hearing Peggy explain now that she really feels like witnesses were supposed to be part of the trial phase of impeachment, and that's not what we saw.
Right. And I mean, that certainly is an argument that Democrats have made and Democrats will continue to make, to say we didn't hear some really important witnesses that had some firsthand evidence here. I mean, John Bolton, I think, really comes to the forefront there as somebody who Democrats certainly wanted to call and may very well have some relevant things to say. Now, even though this is going to be the end of the impeachment process in all likelihood tomorrow with the acquittal vote, I do think that this conversation about Trump's conduct in office is still going to be very much a big part of the campaign moving forward. So even though, you know, pretty close to 100% chance that President Trump will not get removed from office tomorrow, this will be a really central part of the argument that Democrats will make in the lead up to November.
And let's go ahead now and bring Pat from McHenry, Illinois, into the conversation. Pat, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just am so disappointed in the Congress that people have become so partisan that there's like no independent thinking anymore. I will admit that I was very much in favor of Trump being impeached and removed from office, but I just think it's pathetic how things are now happening only along party lines, and that no one, that Republicans in particular, feel so threatened, it appears, by Donald Trump and those who are strong supporters of his, that they just have to go along with whatever he does.
Pat, yeah, thanks for weighing in on that. And Paul, I wonder how much we can really glean and understand whether Republicans are, as Pat said, you know, concerned about their political viability if they go against the president, or if they really do believe what they're saying and they support him. And this is just a different line of conversation that we've had from Republicans in this era.
Yeah, and in some ways it's hard to separate those two in terms of what they really believe and then what is actually good for them politically. But I do think that on the latter point, at least, Republicans have made the calculation that going against President Trump is not going to end well for them, you know, in a potential primary. So someone like Senator Collins, for instance, who has cultivated a moderate reputation, nevertheless, and really isn't too much of a friend of Trump in terms of some of the comments she's made in the past, has nevertheless sided with Trump on this. And so I think it is a reflection of some very, very sharp partisanship these days, in which members of each party, both in both the House, the Senate, elsewhere, are expected to stay in line regardless with the rest of their party. So that dynamic is very much in play right now.
Brings up the question of separation of powers, you know, how that all works when it seems like it's really the parties working together and not necessarily the different branches of government.
Right. And you know, this has been another criticism that Democrats have brought up to say, well, where is our allegiance to separation of powers in the Constitution and our independent congressional duty to push back against another branch of government? But of course, you know, during the Obama days, and then no doubt with a future Democratic president as well, Republicans will make the argument, that same exact argument, that Democratic members of Congress aren't pushing back against their president. So that partisanship, I think it's a very good point that that partisanship has become really more important than institutional prerogatives, like the prerogatives of Congress versus the executive branch.
We're talking to Paul Nolet, who's an associate professor and is chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. And we're discussing the ongoing impeachment trial. And we've got Keith from Madison on the line. Keith, thanks for joining us.
Hey, hello.
Hey, what's your take?
Well, we've seen a lot lately regarding the Senate's actions, and people have, you know, referenced witnesses, but my understanding is that the House had quite a number of witnesses, I think 28 altogether. And if they had done a better job with the investigation, if they had done a better job procedurally, if they had called the additional witnesses that they were complaining about when it got to the Senate, this whole process would have been much smoother. There'd be much less rancor. People would be less disappointed because they would have had a much cleaner and more effective set of articles if that's what would have happened. It's the House that messed this up.
Yeah, Keith, thanks for that. And we hear that, too, a pushback to the witness conversation in the Senate. We've heard U.S. senators say, hey, it's not our job to do all of the discovery for the House. They should have come up with more evidence if they wanted more witnesses. What do you think about that, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be certainly discussion about whether the House made a strategic mistake by moving too quickly, perhaps, on the impeachment. But it is also worth noting that a lot of this, the House members saw a lot of the witnesses being blocked by the White House in a way that would spark judicial battles that would probably go on for months or even potentially years. So when it came to John Bolton, for instance, you know, it wasn't until a court opinion that would allow him to testify, which came after the impeachment, that I think Democrats in the Senate said, well, now that Bolton is free to testify, according to the court, you know, he should be called here. So the situation has changed. That's what a number of the Democrats would argue. But I do think that there is some reflection to say, well, you know, should the House have waited longer and tried to collect more evidence? But that's going to be part of the debate for, you know, through November and then even beyond.
Let's bring Jeff from Bloomer into the discussion now. Jeff, what's on your mind?
My concern was that the Chief Justice didn't really preside over a trial and that he was appeared to be just a pawn in the show.
What do you mean by
that?
What do you think Chief Justice John Roberts could have done?
I think he could have requested more more information, could have been more of a official in the thing instead of just, you know, I see him as a judge presiding over trial, and I think his duty is to seek the truth.
All right.
And I didn't see that.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. You know, we did see John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, step in, Paul, when we had, you know, Senator Rand Paul send a question up to the Chief Justice, and he wouldn't take it because it named the so-called whistleblower. We know Wisconsin's Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson today apparently named the whistleblower in a news call. So what is the role of the Chief Justice under these circumstances?
Yeah. And here I would actually defend Chief Justice Roberts here, because I think it goes back to that question about separation of powers. This isn't a typical trial like you might see in, say, a criminal trial. This is an impeachment trial where really the House and then the Senate are running the show. So I think if the Chief Justice ended up taking over the show, then there'd be some real concerns about separation of powers and the courts getting too involved here. So I think Roberts, like Rehnquist before him during the Clinton, Chief Justice Rehnquist during the Clinton impeachment, you know, they had a very hands-off approach here, which I think for a Chief Justice who is presiding over this Senate-run trial, I think that is the appropriate approach to take.
And Paul Nolet, I really appreciate your time with us today, breaking down all of the aspects of the ongoing impeachment trial here. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
And we've been talking with Paul Nolet, who's an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. And he joined us today to talk about the ongoing impeachment trial in the Senate. And the Senate is actually scheduled to vote tomorrow afternoon. So we'll keep you updated about what's going on there on the Senate.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look back at President Trump's State of the Union address scheduled to be delivered tonight and what it could ultimately mean for the presidential race down the road.
Brexit finally happened after years of waiting. And now what will it mean for Wisconsin? A state trade official joins the show for a look at Wisconsin exports and how the untidy European divorce could affect them.
And it can be hard to keep track of the ever-changing world of science, the latest news, discoveries, reports, and so on. We count on science writers and reporters to bring complicated issues into the public eye in a way that even I can understand them. Our guest tells us what goes into the craft of science writing.
That's coming up, Matt, and much more tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then, are you a fan of something? Maybe a book, a movie, a TV series, a video game, whatever it may be. Do you ever feel like you maybe don't have enough geek cred or knowledge to declare that to others? We'll find out what it means to be geek adjacent. You can weigh in maybe with your own story right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.